Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will be talking about The Wizard of Oz. I think for a lot of people who are listening, the version that you know is the film version, the one that came out in 1939 that made Judy Garland a star. It's probably one that almost everyone has seen. But certainly, long before The Wizard of Oz was a movie, it was a book. And in fact, this year marks the 100th anniversary of The Wizard of Oz. We'll be talking this morning about the book and about the man who created it, L. Frank Baum. And our guest for this program is Michael Patrick Hearn. He is the world's leading Oz scholar. He is working on a biography, a definitive biography of Frank Baum. He also co-authored a biography of William Wallace Denslow, who was the artist that provided the illustrations for the first edition of Wizard of Oz. He has also, that is, Mr. Hearn, has also annotated Dickens' Christmas Carol and Mark Twain's Huckleberry Finn, and he is also the editor of the annotated Wizard of Oz Centennial Edition, which just came out this fall, published by W.W. Norton. So you might want to take a look at that. It's quite interesting if you have never read the original Wizard of Oz, just for the fact that it presents the text and the illustrations. And there are some interesting differences between this book, this original, and the version that probably we all know best, the film version. But also it has material on L. Frank Baum and his life. And here and there, some rather interesting notes on what indeed might have inspired various features of this tale. And as we talk this morning with our guest, Michael Patrick Hearn, you certainly should feel free to call in. Maybe you'll have questions. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That means no matter where you're listening, if it would be a long-distance call for you, well, you can use the toll-free number and we'll pay for it. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. And we also have that toll-free line, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Hearn, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Apparently your interest in Baum and in Oz goes back some time.
When I was a little boy, yes.
So that is indeed the origins are probably when you first read this book when you were a child.
Yes. I wanted to learn more about L. Frank Baum. When I was growing up, a lot of the Oz books, there are 14 Oz books in the series, not just The Wizard, and not all of them were available in the library, so I wanted to read all the Oz books and also learn more about L. Frank Baum. There just was nothing much about him. But I happened to join the International Wizard of Oz Club when I was 10 years old, and I started corresponding with all these Oz collectors and writers and experts on Oz and Baum. And it just sort of grew from there.
Well, here, perhaps just to start, we should invite you to tell us a little bit more about this man. He certainly, before he became a children's writer, he did a lot of other things, including being involved in business, not terribly successfully, but there was a depression on at the time, so I guess we probably couldn't blame him. He was a traveling salesman. He wrote a book about raising chickens. A lot of sort of an interesting sort of varied resume before he gets around to writing this book.
Well, he raised chickens. He manufactured axle grease in Syracuse, New York. He was an actor. He toured the country in his own play, The Maid of Erin. He sold crockery on the road. He had a news, country newspaper in South Dakota, and he also ran a variety store there. And he was jack of all trades, a master of none, until he started writing children's books.
There is an interesting introduction to that he wrote,
yes,
to the book, the Oz book, where he writes about the importance of fairy tales and folk tales for children, but also talks about the fact that at this point, which was 1900, he felt that what was needed were more modern, quote-unquote, modern stories.
Modernized fairy tales.
What was it that he was interested in trying to do, and in what way would you say that a story like Wizard of Oz, Wonderful Wizard of Oz, is modern or would have been modern in 1900?
Well, he wanted to write a book, a fairy tale, based upon Native American materials. So he takes his young heroine from Kansas, transports her to a fantasy land by a Kansas cyclone, rather than sends her down a rabbit hole like Alice in Wonderland when she enters her adventure. He also didn't go to the Black Hills. He didn't have to go to Europe to find material to write fairy tales. And he was reacting against what he thought were the frightening elements in the Andersen and Grimm fairy tales, traditional fairy tales.
Hmm. And yet at the same time, I suppose there, if you wanted to find things to be frightened of in this story, there are monsters. There's the witch. Although, interestingly enough, in the book, she doesn't figure as prominently as she does in the film.
Well, there certainly are dangers to be overcome in Oz, but there are no unnecessary punishments. For example, when Dorothy is captured by the Wicked Witch of the West, she's made to do housework. Mm-hmm. That's probably the worst thing that any American little girl would be forced to do in Oz, rather than making her, Hansel and Gretel. Gretel has to fatten up her brother, so the witch will eat him. That's something you don't find in Oz. I mean, the Wicked Witch isn't going to eat Dorothy. She's just going to make her do housework.
Yeah. Now, I suppose another way in which this would have been modern in 1900 is the fact that the hero of the story is a girl.
Is a girl, yes. Well, American feminists have embraced The Wizard of Oz because they have claimed that Dorothy is the first feminist American heroine. Some of them don't even recognize Jo March because she ends up marrying Professor Bear at the end of Little Women. And our Dorothy does not sit at home waiting for a prince to come. She goes out and solves her own problems. She gets back to Kansas.
Yeah. Another interesting difference between the book, The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, and the film that we know is that in the movie, as people will recall, Dorothy gets conked on the head, and she dreams going to Oz. And in the end, of course, she wakes up and she's back home. In the book, The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy actually goes there. Oz is a place. She goes physically, and then in subsequent books, she goes back.
The dream is all Hollywood. Baum created this secondary world, this land of Oz, where Dorothy has her adventures. And as the series progressed, by the sixth book, which he hoped to end the series with, Dorothy goes to live in Oz with Aunt Em and Uncle Henry.
And that's interesting. One of my colleagues pointed that out to me, that eventually Dorothy goes and she stays there.
Oh, yes.
And one wonders, I suppose, a lot of people have taken psychoanalytic sort of approaches to analyzing what Oz is all about, but that he sort of raised this issue about whether, in fact, Oz becomes a kind of a refuge, in fact, from...
A sanctuary.
A sanctuary,
yes, because
from the realities of the world.
The reason that Dorothy and Em and Uncle Henry are invited to live in Oz is because the banks are going to foreclose on the mortgage of the farm in Kansas, and they're going to be thrown out into the street.
Hmm.
And it looks like Dorothy may have to do housework to support her aunt.
There, we're back to that housework,
yes,
motif again.
And that.
Another thing that I think it certainly struck me as I started to read the story here that Frank Baum wrote is how grim the description of Kansas is. And he talks about the fact that here where he's describing her aunt and uncle, he writes, when Aunt Em came to live there in Kansas, she was a young, pretty wife. The sun and wind had changed her. They had taken the sparkle from her eyes and left them a sober gray. And here we get into this. Everything is gray. She's gray. The uncle's gray. The place is gray. The only thing in the whole place that's not gray is Toto.
Yes. Wizard of Oz is not a little house on the prairie. L. Frank Baum had lived on the prairie in South Dakota. He'd also seen what the life out west, how hard it bent on his in-laws. His sister-in-law had a very, very hard life living out homesteading on the prairie. I'm quite sure he was thinking of her and her husband and how hard the life was out there. And, you know, there are many examples of, people being defeated by the land. There are people who left the East, settled in the West, had no idea what farming was, and were, you know, basically destroyed by the landscape.
Yeah, I think it's interesting too that you were talking about the fact that when he was thinking about writing this modern fairy tale, he also was interested in setting it in the United States.
Yes.
and having it be very American and not
more American than Kansas.
Exactly. I mean, not only is it very American, but it's also very Midwestern.
Oh yes. Well, he was very much a Midwesterner. He wrote The Wizard of Oz in Chicago. Denslow also lived in Chicago, and he felt he was writing an important work for that grew out of the soil of the Midwest.
Hmm. It was also, I gather, at least perhaps the idea of the Emerald City and some aspects of Oz were inspired by the Columbian
Exposition
there in 1893 in Chicago, where Baum was living.
Well, that was the Great White City, which was built out of the swamps, just like the Emerald City arises out of nowhere in the middle of Oz. And it was the center of the universe in 1893, but it was all an illusion. It looked like marble, but it was actually plaster. Same thing in the Emerald City. Everyone has to wear green glasses, so they think that everything in the Emerald City is green. So the wizards of Chicago are just as deceptive, as the Wizard of Oz in the building of his Emerald City.
I think that's an interesting little thing that the reason that it was everybody thought that it was the Emerald City was that the wizard had everybody essentially wearing dark glasses. They were all wearing green glasses, so of course everything looked green.
Everything looked green. As soon as you entered the Emerald City, they were locked on, so you couldn't take them off. And I mean, the wizard, of course, admits that there are emeralds built into the city, but it's no greener than any other city.
Hmm. That's what was Baum trying to make some sort of larger point there, or was that just a?
Well, I think he believed in that you cannot put your faith in other people or in other illusions. You have to really rely on yourself, and this is what happens with Dorothy and her friends. It's, you know, the Scarecrow finally looks into himself and realizes that he certainly has an intellect. He just doesn't have the brains to use it. Tin Woodman is certainly very tender-hearted, even though he doesn't have a heart yet. And the Cowardly Lion certainly shows his bravery, even though he doesn't have any courage, until the Wizard of Oz gives them each a tangible symbol of the object that they seek. And Dorothy herself has to look into herself and decide that she is going to go out there and return to Kansas. And she does. Nothing will keep that girl from getting back to her Aunt Em and Uncle Henry.
Mm. And I suppose, again, here, if we're talking about this being a very American story, the idea of self-reliance is, of course, one of our big American myths.
Back to Emerson.
Yeah.
And certainly Baum was well-schooled in, you know, American traditions.
I should introduce again, probably, our guest for anyone who's tuned in the last little bit here. We're talking with Michael Patrick Hearn, who is probably the world's leading scholar on Oz and the person who created Oz 100 years ago, L. Frank Baum. He is our guest. Patrick Hearn has edited an annotated version of the original Wizard of Oz out in a centennial edition. It did come out first in 1900. The one that's out now is published by W.W. Norton.
And illustrated by W.W. Denslow.
Yes, indeed. A couple of W.W.'s there. And so people can enjoy the original illustrations and text so they can see what it was like when it first came out. And then also there are a number of notes that are provided by our guest here looking at perhaps various things that might have inspired the characters and the events, and also little things like how people have reacted to the story over the years and a lot of the questions that people were interested in. As we talked about a moment ago, I mentioned the fact that one of the differences between the book and the film is that in the book, Dorothy, Oz is a real place. It's not imaginary. Dorothy actually goes there. And I know that one of the sort of sports for Oz scholars and people who are interested in Oz is the question, where is Oz?
Yes.
I think you mentioned in the text, in fact, that people ask Frank Baum. They said, well, where is this place? Where is Oz?
Well, he sort of gives a hint that it might be in the South Pacific. And I think Baum was probably thinking of, you know, the whole tradition of Thomas More's Utopia, which is right off the coast of, I think it's off the coast of South America. It's just this other country that you can go to if you just happen to have the right, the right form of transportation, let's say a cyclone or a shipwreck or an earthquake, you can get to Oz.
Mm. And those were in subsequent books, these were the methods by which Dorothy went back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we have a couple of callers. People are certainly welcome to call. They have questions, comments. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And so let's talk with some folks here. Caller in Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
My wife is a school teacher, and she teaches Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. And she's come upon a problem with teaching Harry Potter in that a lot of religious groups seem to think there's too much relationship with wizardry and deviltry or whatever you want to come up with the word for it. And so they don't want the book around. Now, it seems, though, with Wizard of Oz, there didn't seem to be quite that sort of thing, or was there?
Oh, actually, the Wizard of Oz has been attacked by fundamentalists. There was, have been attempts to ban it, just like the Harry Potter books a few years ago, because of the good witches, the wicked witches. Also, they feel that human characteristics are all God-given. You don't go out and get them from humbug wizards.
Ah, I see. So he had the same problem.
He had the same problem, yes. Not in his lifetime, and this is something fairly recent.
Oh.
Yeah, it's only within the last, I think, since the 1980s, there was a concerted effort to ban, fundamentalists tried to ban The Wizard of Oz.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I think that it's the case that certainly when the book was first published, the response was very, very positive.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, no question about it. It was the best-selling children's book of the year, and the reviews were generally laudatory.
We have another caller. This is locally in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hi. When I saw the special about the Wizard of Oz books on television quite a number of years ago, my kids were small, they pointed out that librarians at the time didn't think much of the books and didn't want to stock them in libraries. And yet, like Harry Potter now, for my kids, it was something that really encouraged them to read. They really enjoyed the stories and liked having the serial aspect of it. You know, there was more to read after you finished one, and they really got into reading as a result of that, my discovering that there was more than one story. I didn't realize that there was more than one until I saw that TV program. And
well,
go ahead.
Well, there was this time when the Oz books were unofficially banned from many libraries in the country. One reason was because it was a series, and they considered all series bad. Well, most series, the Nancy Drew books, the Tom Swift books, the Hardy Boys, were all considered trash, and The Wizard of Oz were thrown out the Oz books were thrown out along with these other series books. But I think there also was a certain displeasure with American fantasy. They, you know, many of the children's librarians accepted Grimm and Anderson. They may also have been offended by Baum's essay, the introduction to The Wizard of Oz, where he said we need a new kind of fairy tale. But they embraced European fairy tales, but were not so interested in modern or American fairy tales. And I think also the books were so popular, how could they be good? And I think that was one prejudice against them. They were doing so well that you know, parents were buying them, kids were reading them, and the libraries had a certain resistance to something that was so popular, it could not be literature.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to mention, too, that I just a few years ago I saw in a bookstore a book, I think the title was Wicked. It's someone's telling of the Oz story from the point of view of the Wicked Witch of the...
Oh, yes, you're thinking of Wicked by Gregory Maguire.
Could be.
Yes.
It was really fascinating to see the story retold from another character's point of view.
There's a subgenre of books inspired by The Wizard of Oz. There was, I think, Jeffrey Ryman's Was. There have been several science fiction stories that have been inspired by The Wizard of Oz and by the other Oz books. Ray Bradbury often mentions Oz in his stories. But it's remarkable how these books have inspired people to become writers. Salman Rushdie said that when he saw The Wizard of Oz as a kid, that made him want to become a writer. He wrote his first story when he was a kid after seeing the film based upon The Wizard of Oz. William Styron, E.L. Doctorow, Gore Vidal, all these writers have talked about how important the Oz books were when they were children.
Mm, interesting. Do you mention any of this in your annotated?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. And again, to another Urbana person here, this is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I just started listening about 5 or 10 minutes ago, so I don't know if you've talked at any length about the sequels to The Wizard of Oz. My 5-year-old daughter and I have loved The Wizard of Oz. I read it to her about 6 months ago, so now we are going through the whole series. We've read The Marvelous Land of Oz, and now we're in the middle of Ozma of Oz, and they are about the most peculiar books. They're just so wonderful and imaginative and exciting, and I just would like to recommend everybody out there that if you like The Wizard of Oz, just at least so far for us, just keep going.
Oh, well, glad to hear that.
What is your sense of these books?
Oh, I like the entire series. Of course, The Wizard of Oz has this resonance that goes beyond the rest of the series, but Baum also wrote many other books besides the Oz books. He wrote a number of other fantasies, Queen Zixi of Ix and Sky Island and Sea Fairies and Enchanted Island of You, which are excellent fairy tales on their own.
Yeah, I'm impressed at how well they're written. I mean, my son is reading Harry Potter, and the use of imagination in these books by Baum are just really fantastic. Coming upon a tree that grows lunch pails and light boxes and so forth. And right now we're reading about the frightening Wheelers, these people who have wheels.
The Wheelers, yes.
Yeah, wheels instead of hands and feet, and they're kind of scary.
Yeah, and you never know what's going to happen next.
Yes, exactly. That's the most wonderful thing. And not also in terms of a cliffhanger. In other words, something extraordinary doesn't happen at the end of a chapter. You have to keep going, but things are consistently exciting and imaginative and wonderful all throughout the chapter, so you're constantly being delighted.
And you never know how it's going to resolve itself in the end. So
yeah.
That keeps the child interested. It's also the wonderful characters he creates, like Tick-Tock, the clockwork man who can do everything but live.
we just got to Tick-Tock, yeah. Also, I thought you might want to talk about, because I found it so peculiar, but in the second book, The Marvelous Land of Oz, there's a character named Tip.
Yes.
A boy who, at the end of the book, turns out, in fact, to actually be a girl, but he was bewitched into being a boy. And that just really took me for a loop, and especially these days in talking about manipulation and the variability of gender and so forth, to have something like that in a children's book, nearly a century ago, just surprised me so much.
Well, I think he was dealing with a certain theatrical convention. When The Wizard of Oz came out, Baum adapted as a musical comedy that came out in 1902. It was an enormous success as a musical extravaganza. It was sort of like the Cats of its day. It was enormously popular. And Baum wrote The Land of Oz to be done as a musical comedy. And a convention of the musical comedy, musical extravaganza, was a transformation scene in which the principal boy would become transformed into a fairy at the end.
Wow.
Of course, Peter Pan is in that tradition too, where you have the principal boy, the major male character played by a girl in tights. And so Baum was playing with this convention. And I think it's also significant that Tip, who has spent all the book until the end, Tip is a boy, suddenly becomes princess, the ruler of Oz. So Baum is really combining both elements, the masculine and feminine, in the right ruler of Oz.
Yeah. Ah, great point. Anyway, they're wonderful books, and I'm enjoying this program. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, there, other than the film of 1939 with Judy Garland that we know, there were other attempts at filming this story or films that were inspired by it. Frank Baum did not live to see the most famous one. He died in 1919?
1919, yeah.
But I am curious at what was their reaction to that film from his family or from anybody who were particularly Baum partisans?
Well, the the Baum family were invited to an early preview of the picture, and evidently it was very frightening for little kids, and Margaret Hamilton was scaring the daylights out of these kids, and some of them had to be taken out of the theater. And MGM then took out some lines from the film that they thought were a little too frightening for kids. And Baum's widow, Maud, always said that she liked the picture, although she thought that the Wicked Witch was a little too frightening.
Yeah, I guess...
Margaret Hamilton thought she was too frightening. She wouldn't allow her son to see the picture until he was old enough.
Really? Well, that seems to me, just having had conversations with people who talked about having seen the movie when they were little, that's the thing that people always talk about. And again, that's sort of an interesting difference that between the book and the film, is that in the film, the witch becomes a central character, someone who appears all the way through the narrative. And in the book, she doesn't physically appear until later,
the center of the book,
and as you say that once she gets her hands on Dorothy, the worst thing that she has Dorothy do is housework,
clean the floor, and it's also interesting. A number of psychiatrists have told me about using the Wizard of Oz with their patients, and with women, the image that bothers them the most is the transformation of Aunt Em into the Wicked Witch in the crystal ball. But with men, it seems to be the winged monkeys seem to bother them more than anything else.
Which was not something that was invented for the film. The winged monkeys do indeed appear in Baum's book.
Yes, and of course in the movie too. They take Dorothy off to the Wicked Witch's castle.
Something else that I was just really struck by in the book is the fact that the Tin Woodsman starts out as a human being.
Yes, he is a cyborg. He is a human being who somehow offends the Wicked Witch, who then enchants his axe. So he first cuts off an arm, then the other arm, then a leg, then he cuts his torso in half. Each time he loses a part of his body, he goes to a tinsmith who replaces that part. So by the end of his troubles, he's even lost his head. Even his head has been replaced. So he's entirely made of tin by the end of this incident. And then, unfortunately, he's out chopping down a tree, and it rains, and of course his joints rust.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. One of the notes that you provide that at one point when Baum was doing a display for a store window, it was a hardware store. And so he collected various bits of hardware and sort of put them together to make a human form.
Yes, so that's what his son Harry recalled, that L. Frank Baum was asked to do a display, and he put together this man out of tin, and evidently that inspired the Tin Woodman.
We have some other callers. Let's go to Freeport, line number 4. Hello.
Yeah, well, you just... I haven't heard the whole program, just tuned in recently, but... it was my understanding that the Wicked Witch was the old maid who owned all the land in the Kansas area where she lived. And the young girl lived and tried to take her dog, because the dog was bothering her. And in her dream, she transposed this to these different characters, and the Tin Man and the Cowardly Lion were the hired help on her farm,
And this was all in the movie. This is the invention of the movie. This has not happened in the book. Dorothy actually goes to Oz. She doesn't dream it, and she doesn't transfer her anxieties. Don't become these characters in Oz like in the movie.
Well, I just want to add, I feel that the great emphasis that Baum put on witches and witchcraft in his book sort of de-emphasized Christianity. In that aspect, I can see why these different communities look askance at it,
But you have to also recognize he just treats magic as a power, as knowledge, and it depends upon how you use it. You can either be good, like Glinda, or wicked, like the Wicked Witch of the West. It's like any kind of power, any kind of technology.
Well, Baum also was interested in theosophy.
In spiritualism, in theosophy. He was interested in comparative religion, certainly.
And does that inform the work, you think?
Oh, it certainly does influence it, he also was influenced by his mother-in-law, Matilda Jocelyn Gage, who was an important 19th century feminist, and she believed that at one time women, what we would call witches, it really means wise woman, they owned the knowledge that was that we now call magic. In other words, the knowledge of herbs and of scientific knowledge, and I think that certainly influenced The Wizard of Oz, because the people who possess real power are women, the wicked witches and the good witches. It's not the wizard. He turned out to be a humbug.
Mm-hmm. We'll continue. We have back to Urbana here, line one. Hello.
I'm back again. As you were talking, I had the image in my head of Bobby McFerrin, who was here in concert doing The Wizard of Oz, and he did it in about, I don't know, maybe somebody can correct me, 3 or 4 minutes.
Yes, he does the whole, he does The Wizard of Oz with all these different voices. He does all the Munchkins, and he does...
And the tornado was fantastic.
Yes,
it was. I hope you have that in your book, because it's really worth seeing.
Yeah, well, that's really, you know, he's dealing with the movie as opposed to the to the book. So it's more of a, you know, I think he also went on the road with the ice show 1 year. I think he did it. I have seen him do this wonderful bit of all the everything from the movie in just 3 minutes. He's extraordinary.
Yeah, really, really fun.
Mm. Well, one of the things that says, I guess, is also that at least as far as his film is concerned, almost everybody has seen it, and more than once, and enough so that. It's so ingrained in our brains that you could do a whirlwind impression, and people would get it. Would know exactly what it was you were doing.
Well, you can hardly see a situation comedy now on TV without some reference to The Wizard of Oz. I think 2 weeks ago I think I saw 3 shows that mentioned there was some reference to The Wizard of Oz. You see in all these movies. I mean, I'm melting is always. And, or, you know, things like I'll Get You and Your Little Dog Too, you know, and these are as much of the culture as, I mean, almost any motion picture. Probably no other motion picture is as well known as The Wizard of Oz, certainly not in America. I mean, when I was growing up, you had to wait and see it once a year on TV. It was such a chore. Mm-hmm. But nowadays, you know, kids have their VCRs, just plug it in and see it anytime they want.
Yeah. Another Urbana caller, line two.
My Australian friends are fond of referring to their country as Oz, and I'm wondering if that played any role in Baum's crafting of the story.
Well, by coincidence, the third Oz book, Ozma of Oz, Dorothy goes on a sea voyage with Uncle Henry. He's not well, and they're heading towards Australia. And that's when she gets thrown off her. There's a storm at sea, and she gets thrown overboard in a chicken coop, and eventually lands on the shores of the Land of Ev. And it's from there that she goes to the Land of Oz.
So maybe it did.
So it seems like Baum may have had Australia a bit in mind, although he said that the word Oz. Was that he was trying to think of a name, and he was looking around his study, and he saw his filing cabinet, and there were 3 drawers, A to G, H to N, and O to Z. And when he saw Oz, he says, there, O to Z, that's the name he was looking for.
Okay. I'll accept your argument. You wonder if it might not have had some subliminal influence?
Very likely. But, of course, that's the story L. Frank Baum told.
Yeah, okay, fine, thanks.
All right, thank you. Well, and I think that there is some suggestion, at least, that might be apocryphal, and that, or perhaps that that it's just more complicated simply than that there might have been other sorts of influences.
Well, there are other theories that maybe took it from Dickens' nickname, Boz, took B away and for Baum and was left with Oz. If you transfer the symbol of New York State, where he was born, NY, transpose it one letter, you have O, and then you have Z. So that, you know, anyone can create any theory, but this was his explanation. He said that he got it off his filing cabinet.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Let me again tell you that our guest is Michael Patrick Hearn. He's the world's leading Oz scholar. He is working on a definitive biography of Frank Baum. He's also co-authored a biography of William Wallace Denslow, and he was the artist that provided the illustrations for the first Oz book. And he also is the editor of the Annotated Wizard of Oz Centennial Edition. This is indeed the 100th year. It was published first, came out published first in 1900. And this is published by Norton and came out this fall. And it contains a facsimile of that original with the original text and the original illustrations, and then also some biographical information on L. Frank Baum and some commentary on various points in the story. And again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm sure that over time that various people have read all sorts of things into into this story. Do you think, though, Baum have a kind of, was he interested in making some kind of political statement with this?
I really don't think so. I think Baum was interested, first of all, in telling a story that would be compelling to children. And there's some sly little asides in there. Of course, The Wizard of Oz turns out to be no more than a humbug, like most of our political leaders certainly have proven to be. You know, be wary of those men behind the curtain, because you don't know what they're trying to pull. And but I don't think Baum was a political thinker. I think he might have commented on his time, certainly, but I don't think he had any agenda or any political allegory working through his books.
Yeah, I do like the acknowledgement of human frailty. One of the lines that is lifted right from Baum's text that ends up in the movie is, once the wizard has been unmasked, Dorothy says to him, "You're a bad man," and he says, "No, I'm a good man. I'm just a bad wizard."
Bad wizard, yes.
Other callers here. Let's see. Again, we'll go back to I think Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yes. I just joined the show. You may have already answered this question. There has been some literature written about his stories that, in fact, they were political or economic, in the sense that he had some sort of connection with Farmer Labor Party in the Midwest and was looking at the big corporations as very evil and so on, and that these were stories kind of making the statement in his way, in addition to being children's stories. Is there any
well,
for that?
One theory is that The Wizard of Oz is a parable in populism. Now, this was invented by a junior high school teacher in the 1960s, and many of the points were made by his students. So this is not the work of a American historian or scholar. The other thing is, Baum was not a populist. He did not support William Jennings Bryan. In fact, he wrote a poem in support of McKinley and the gold standard. I mean, if there was any political theory or any political slant he had, it certainly was more to the Republican Party. The newspaper he edited in South Dakota was a Republican paper. But I don't think Baum was really a political thinker. He seemed to go from one way to the other. And when The Wizard of Oz came out in 1900, it was an election year. It came out right before the election. One of the major issues was the influence of populism. William Jennings Bryan was running on a populist ticket, and not a single review mentions populism. Not a single person, contemporary, recognized this. And I think it's more, it's after the fact, and I don't think Baum thought it. I don't think his contemporaries were aware of it.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay.
All right, let's go to Champaign, line number two. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
I just turned in a little bit ago, and you may have discussed this already, but my question has to do particularly with the film. And I've been told that during the filming, one of the actors that was involved as a part of a munchkin committed suicide and hung himself, actually, in a tree, and that is actually captured in the film. And I wondered if you...
No truth at all to that.
That's one of the great
urban legends
surrounding this movie.
No, not at all. I think what people think is a munchkin hanging there is a crane or a bird in the background who's just flapping his wings.
Something like that
would never have happened on an MGM set. If someone had committed suicide, the crew would not allow a hanged man, to remain on the set. I mean, we're talking about a film factory here. They were very, very careful about the set every day. Everything was checked. They were very concerned with continuity. But I have no idea where this started, but it's just one of those stories.
Well, the person that told it to me, actually, we rented the film, and he stopped the film at a point where that was happening. And I must tell you that at that point in the film, it looked like that's exactly what I was seeing on there, although it's not completely clear, and that's why I was curious what light you could shed on that.
I think you're looking at a crane who's just flapping his wings in the background. This is the Tin Woodman sequence, right?
Yes, it is.
Yes, and it's just that there's this bird in the background who's just flapping his wings. It's not. It would never have happened on MGM lot. First of all, if somebody was fortunate enough to get on the set when nobody was there and commit suicide, it was, you know, once they shut up, they shut up. The studio was locked up and nobody was allowed until the next day. Particularly on a set that, on a film that cost that much money, they're very careful to make sure that no shenanigans were going on the set. And, you know, they would check everything every morning. And I cannot imagine that this could have ever happened at MGM of all studios.
I see. But you've actually looked at that segment of the film, and
yeah, I think if you look closely, you'll see it's. I think it's a crane in the background who's flapping his wings.
Okay, well, I appreciate the information.
All right, thank you for the call. So now we can, if you have a DVD player, everybody go out and get the DVD, and you can.
Well, you're playing it to "Dark Side of the Moon" by Pink Floyd.
At that point, you stop there and you can do your frame by frame analysis and
yes.
See what it is that you see. Well, also here in
subliminal message,
there you go.
For George W. Bush
here in town. Also, interestingly enough, there's a film series that's being organized. We have a theater here, an older theater, a very nice one with a very big screen, and they're going to show some of these movies that I'm sure most of us have only seen on television. They're going to show it on a big screen, so we can even see it blown up to the size of a house, so people can look at it there and see what they think is there.
It is gorgeous on the screen. If you ever see it, it's just an unbelievable experience, particularly when Dorothy opens the door and Kansas suddenly changes from sepia to Technicolor.
Yeah, that's an interesting reflection of that. Way back in the beginning of the program, I talked about how one of the first things that struck me when I was reading the text is this description of Kansas as being gray, and they pick that up in the film because, as people will recall, the beginning and the end is in, well, I grew up, you know, watching it on a black and white TV.
Yeah.
Is black and white, and then the Oz part of the film is in color, and that makes a dramatic point of that difference between Kansas and Oz that you can see even more dramatically in the book.
Mm-hmm. And of course, in the book, Baum changed the locale. He and Denslow, there are all these textual illustrations that change their color as the adventure changes. So Munchkin Land, it's blue. Then when they go to the poppy field, it's red. Emerald City is green. Winky Country is yellow. And it keeps changing until she returns to Kansas.
Mm. Another caller here. This is Champagne, line one. Hello.
Hello, is that me?
Yes.
Okay. I collected the books terrifically and read them when they were first coming out and swapped them with all of my friends. And there was one called The Sea Fairies, which had to do with the Oz background so much that they went below the ocean afterward. And I had a marionette show going that had the characters from that as well.
Well, Sea Fairies was the first book Baum wrote after he originally stopped the series in 19...
Illustrations better than Denslow.
Yeah, and he did two books, Sea Fairies and Sky Island.
Oh,
they
yes.
were not as successful as the Oz books, so he returned to the series with Patchwork Girl in 1913.
Oh, my. I collected them, and we traded them around among everybody else. I wanted to know if you also had come across Poppy Out and Jerry Todd books for boys.
I don't. What were the two series again?
Papillot and the Pedigreed Pickles and Jerry Todd and the Whispering Mummy. They were a bunch of mysteries.
Oh, yes. These were, I think these weren't these all contemporary with the Oz books, right?
Yes. And
yeah, also fantasies. And
They were placed in Streeter.
I didn't hear that. What?
They were placed in Streeter.
Mm-hmm. In Streeter, Illinois.
Streeter, Illinois.
Baum also wrote a series called, he wrote a collection of American fairy tales. One of them takes place on Prairie Avenue in Chicago.
I remember particularly a very bad witch that the, Dorothy came across that had different heads for the different days.
Oh, you're thinking of Princess Languidare.
Yes.
The Princess of Ev, who, instead of changing her dress, she changes her heads from day to day. Yes, Erica Jong has even written a poem about her. She's one of those great metaphors for feminist metaphors in the Oz books.
Well, what a marvelous background of stuff to live against. I collected them furiously, and I still have them somewhere. Thank you very much reminding me of a lot of things I haven't thought about in a while.
Well, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Do we expect that people will continue to read this book for as far into the future as you can imagine?
Oh, certainly. I think it is an American classic now. The 1939 film has done enormous good for the survival of the book, but MJ would not have done The Wizard of Oz were it not a very successful book when they were going to do the picture in 1938. They wanted a property that would compete with Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and they all seemed to come up with The Wizard of Oz.
Hmm. Well,
the best-selling children's book of American children's book of the 20th century.
There is the point where we'll have to stop with our thanks. It's very, very interesting, and I appreciate you taking some time to talk with us.
Thank you.
Our guest, Michael Patrick Hearn, he is the editor of this book that we mentioned. It's titled The Annotated Wizard of Oz Centennial Edition. It's published by W.W. Norton. So if you'd like to look at it, it is out in bookstores.